Thank you for tuning in to Not Suitable for Anyone. As a reminder, if you'd like to financially support the show, don't! Just help other people find us by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, or just telling a friend. If you do want to put your hard-earned dollars to work to support our mission, here's what you can do. Buy or rent movies. Redbox, iTunes, Vudu, it doesn't matter. Hell, even an old-fashioned Blu-ray. Leave a review on Letterboxd or Amazon and tell them that you heard about it right here on
Not Suitable for Anyone.
Hey everybody, thanks and welcome back to another episode of Not Suitable for Anyone. I have an exciting show today because I'm going to be joined in round two by a filmmaker, Eric Falardeau. He is the director of the amazing low-budget body horror Thanatomorphose, which is a French-Canadian film that chronicles the decay of a young woman in a toxic relationship. It's full of really gross special effects and really disturbing imagery, and I really like it a lot, and I hope you check it out. It's also the subject of a brand new physical media release from Tetra Video. There's a beautiful region-free Blu-ray limited edition that was just released. I was lucky enough to snag one. I'm really excited about that. I got a chance to watch it. And then Eric and I talked all about it and his approach to filmmaking and tons of other stuff. So that's all coming your way in round two. Before we get into the show today, I wanted to take a minute because I actually watched a movie, a non-independent, non-horror, bizarro, weird movie over this past Memorial Day weekend with my family. And I found it really, really inspiring, and it was, I felt almost as if it was made for me and made for this podcast. You might have heard about a movie on Netflix called The Mitchells vs. the Machines. It's a Lord & Miller production. If you're familiar with Philip Lord and Chris Miller, they're the people responsible for movies like The Lego Movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. They make animated films that are really funny, really, you know, kind of wacky and goofy, that take some, you know, ridiculous concepts, they take some ridiculous risks with, you know, the stories and the characters. They just make really good, really fun movies. And The Mitchells versus the Machines is no exception. Now, they didn't direct or I think even write this, but they produced it, and you can kind of see their influences all over it. Now, why am I talking about The Mitchells versus the Machines on this podcast? You know, this podcast is all about highlighting those extremely low-budget movies, those extremely obscure movies, the movies nobody's talking about. A lot of people are probably talking about The Mitchells versus the Machines. I even held off on watching it because I saw it was really popular, and I said, okay, well, that's everyone seems to like it. I'm not going to get anything, you know, new out of watching it that everyone else isn't already getting. And that was kind of my attitude towards it. But my wife said, well, let's watch it anyway, you know, it'll be a good family watch. So we sat down, we put it on, and I'm telling you, it is the perfect movie for this podcast, and it's the perfect movie to inspire you out there if you are a filmmaker and you just want to go out and create something and not worry about things like financing and structure and rules and studios, and just want to create. Because a lot of people aren't really talking about the movie in detail because they don't want to spoil it, and they say, oh, it's great, you should just go see it. And sure, that's great advice as far as like going in fresh and everything. But, you know, for me, I just needed something a little bit more, I think, to sell me on this, and I would have been there day one had I known this this one little factor, or maybe two little factoids. First of all, main character's name is Katie, and the movie kind of picks up with her about to go off to college, to film school. She wants to be a filmmaker. Okay, you know, check one there. But we sort of see this flashback of her growing up, where she is using a home video camera to make her own home movies, and she's showing them to her family, and she's showing them to her friends, and she's showing them at the school.
Behold, cinema!
And she's creating all of these movies with kind of these wacky, outlandish concepts, and she's putting it all up on YouTube. It's really fantastic. Doing like green screen work and stuff, and using her dog, the family pet, as a character in the movie, and just making something really creative and really fun and obviously very weird because it's, you know, a talking dog or what have you. And, you know, doing all of these, you know, green screen special effects and stuff. By the end of the movie, it's her weird, crazy movies that save the day in the end. It's called The Mitchells Versus the Machines. They're literally in this battle against this machine uprising and sort of robot apocalypse. And her, you know, weird, bizarre movies that she's making, by herself for free, you know, with no money, those are what save the day at the end of this movie. And I thought that's just perfect, because that's the kind of thing I love is a movie that's just made because the creator had something, you know, new to add, and they did it. And Lord and Miller basically saying, yeah, and you know what? That's going to save the world someday. So Mitchells Versus the Machines, check it out right now. Well, not right now, because you're listening to this podcast, but, you know, listen to the podcast and then check out The Mitchells Versus the Machines. Okay. All right, what else? Okay, so here's what we're going to do, because I spent a little bit more time talking about Mitchells Versus the Machines than I had planned, so I'm going to skip over the short film for this week. I'll have a new one to talk about, I'm sure, next week, but if you haven't yet, go back to last week and listen to me talk about Crowhand and Arrow Player and check out all the awesome short films that are on there. I'll just shout out real quickly one of the other short films that I also watched that was made by the same director as Crowhand, and it's another good one that you should absolutely check out. Really funny. It's called The Devil's Asshole. Yeah, it's pretty fucking hilarious. I'm not even gonna say anything about it. Just go check that out. Check out Arrow Player in general. It's pretty awesome, and I'll probably be talking more about them in general and some more movies that are up there for you to watch in the coming weeks. I want to talk about a new trailer that I just saw for the first time that. Is for a movie that's out right now. You can actually go out and watch it. You can rent it on VOD. It's called 15 Things You Didn't Know About Bigfoot. Number one will shock you, surprise you, something like that. Number one will blow your mind. Yeah, 15 Things You Didn't Know About Bigfoot. Number one will blow your mind. It's a very, you know, clickbaity title. This hit festivals under a different name. I think it was called The Vice Guide to Bigfoot. It's essentially a Bigfoot horror mockumentary / found footage, and so it's done in that style, which looks pretty funny. This movie looks pretty freaking hilarious. There's this Bigfooting character, you know, one of these guys who goes out, you know, hunting for Bigfoot. Bigfoot shows up. I guess you get at least some look at him. It's not going to spend the whole movie, you know, going, is Bigfoot real or not? Because now they show him, you know, directly in the trailer, like knocking people's heads off and shit. I've heard a lot of good things about this. I've heard it's really funny. This was produced by Aaron Kuntz, who you might remember was on this show way back in the first few episodes. He made a movie called Camera Obscura, and last year had a movie come out called The Pale Door, which was pretty awesome, and produced an anthology called Scare Package. Both of those, I think, are still available on Shudder, and you should check those out, too. But this is another one from Aaron Kuntz, producer. The director is Zach Lamplug. Hasn't necessarily done anything that you would have recognized, and he was the writer, and he was one of the co-writers, and the director, the other writer, is Brian Emond. So, yeah, new film from some new voices. It looks hilarious. I'm gonna try to check it out. My stack of things to be watched is kind of growing, so hopefully I'll get to it sooner rather than later. But that's 15 things you didn't know about Bigfoot. It looks pretty hilarious. Put the link to the trailer in the show notes, as always. Now, for this week's crowdfunding project, I have a new one that looks really interesting. They are trying to raise $25,000 for post-production work, and it's from the writer and director is named Bill Posley. He's a stand-up comedian, and I'll just let him explain it.
Hi, my name's Bill Posley, and I'm the director and co-writer of the movie Bitch Ass.
All right, yeah, the movie is called Bitch Ass, and already I'm on board, and I'm interested. You have my attention, you have my curiosity at this point. But he goes on, and this is interesting. So give a listen.
I'm not just asking you to donate to a movie. I'm asking you to donate to something that I think might be a part of history. You see, this is an all-black horror film, which for the first time stars a black masked serial killer. Up until this point, all mass serial killers in films have been white. Think about it.
Now, I don't know if that's 100% true, but I certainly can't think of one, off the top of my head. So, and either way, this is cool. Even if there is one out there that you can think of, there aren't many. There's not, like, a lot of examples, and there's just not as many all-black cast, all-black, made and produced horror films, period. So some of the influences that they talk about in the pitch that they want to sort of emulate and bring in as an homage include titles, some great titles like Tales from the Hood, The People Under the Stairs, and prominent 90s black films like Set It Off, Above the Rim, and even Meteor Man. And now I'm just even more interested. He wants it to look gritty. He wants it to be grindhouse. So I'm really into this. I'm looking forward to it. I'm not too familiar with Posley, but apparently he is somewhat of a known actor and comedian in the space. I'm a big fan of comedians getting involved in horror. We've seen a number of occasions where this has worked out really, really well. And there's no reason to think that this this time won't either. So check out the pitch, the Indiegogo for Bitch Ass. It's available. It's up right now. Their campaign is kind of just getting started. They still got well over 20 days left. They're about almost a quarter of the way to their goal. They're looking to raise $25,000, which is a very reasonable number. It's for post-production. The movie is in the can. And that's probably the best part, is at the end of the pitch video, you actually see the trailer, and the footage looks good, and it sounds good. So, I'm very optimistic about this. Yeah, so that's Bitch Ass. I don't know. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it. And I will be throwing those guys a few bucks, as always, because I generally don't talk about anything on this show that I'm not willing to put my own money towards. So, okay, so maybe a little bit shorter than anticipated, but I've got a nice long segment here coming up for you guys. A great interview with director Eric Falardeau. We're going to talk all about his movie, Thanatomorphose. You should check it out. Blu-ray's available on Tetra Video. You can also find it on Apple TV and I think other, VOD, digital, on-demand rental places. Thanatomorphose, it's gross, disgusting body horror. It's awesome. It's really disturbed. It's really depraved. There's some fantastic shots in here. It's got time-lapse decay stuff. It's got tons of practical effects, tons of special makeup. The makeup effects artist, he'll get into it a little bit here. The makeup effects artist was actually put on trial for obscenity for his work, not on this specific movie, but on other things. That's how good and how convincing his work is. It's great. So please, Thanatomorphos, check it out, the interview, check it out. Go ahead and listen to the interview. It's not really spoilery. I don't think you can spoil this movie because this movie is an experience more than anything else. So please stick around, check it out. We'll be back right after this.
So it's you can go whatever you want, but usually falardo is okay. You
know? Falardo, okay. All right, great. We sort of got connected, and I reached out to you because I just picked up the new release of your 2012 film Thanatomorphos from Tetra Video. They got a brand new Blu-ray, which is fantastic. I actually just finished rewatching it this morning.
Oh, that's a way to start the day.
So, yeah, great start to a day.
Gives hope for the rest of the day.
So I'm curious, Eric, just sort of right off the bat, I guess what sort of drew you to telling this story?
Well, actually, in 2010, even a bit before that, I started writing the screenplay. I just finished like my master thesis, which was about horror and porn and body fluids and both. So I was kind of in all that intellectual place where I was thinking about the relationship we have with our own bodies and stuff like that. And I kind of had a hard start of the millennium, you know. It wasn't easy on the psychological side. So I had that old feeling of not decaying, but really like of living out of the world, like, and not being part of it. So kind of all mixed together. and I started writing the film at that moment. I was shooting at that time, or I was more or less like finding money to shoot a short film, which was an animated stop motion one that's called Crepuscule. So I was like working on that film while I was writing Thanatomorphos. And it kind of blended together with how I was at that time, at that point in my life, actually. And all the films that I love too as a viewer, you know, I'm really fond of underground horror cinema, it kind of made sense. It kind of was a mixing pot of all these influences and being there at that time of my in my life. So and when I started writing the script, it was really close. It's still close to me, like the final script. But when I started writing the film, I had a male character instead of female character, for example, and all that kind of big details and smaller one that changed over the course of the writing of the movie, because I was trying to, on one part, like distance myself from what I was doing, and also thinking about how we frame male and female bodies in film, and especially in horror film. I thought it was more interesting to have a female character, since there's a lot more, actually they're different, but there's a whole imaginary representations that we put upon female body on screen, and I thought that it was more interesting to tackle that subject too while making the movie. So yeah, that's kind of how it all came together, truly.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think a lot of the message behind this movie, I guess, is would be the same, but I think when you do when you do write in a female protagonist in a story like this, then it also takes on this sort of additional gender construct in terms of women's roles in relationships, and all the way down to the way women are portrayed in film.
Yeah, actually, that was really the point, and that's one of the things that I discussed with the main actress, Kaden Rose. It was really a big thing for me, especially since, as you say, in horror film, we tend to have female characters that are really that are victim, or like if it's slash or the final girl, another kind of construction, like intellectual construction around the genre and genders in horror film. But what really was for me the main focus was really that that idea that the female bodies in art is always invested with a lot of connotation, and so putting a female body on screen naked is has really like a lot of impact and says a lot by itself, and for me it was important to address these matters in the movie, and especially since the character become as the movie progress, the character instead of just becoming a victim, which she's a bit more at the start of the movie, she finds herself. Well, it's too late though, but she finds herself and she gains kind of a power over her life, and a power that doesn't that isn't like given by other characters, just by herself, because she was by herself most of the movie. So for me, yeah, it was really that was part of what I've addressed in the film, and also the two male characters that are just like insufferable, So yeah, I was really like, we were thinking about these issues actually, and it's funny because it was way before all these matters are now part of the general discussion and the main interest. Like now there's a lot of talk about like female protagonists and how they react and the re-empowerment and the post-Me Too, all that kind of stuff, which wasn't there when we shot the movie in 2011, actually. It was there, it was but not as...
It wasn't talked about. It wasn't as prominent. Yeah,
so it's really funny when I think back at the movie on that perspective. I was like, well, okay, there was something going on. I think feeling that something was coming.
Right.
Movie,
Yeah. If you even think back to something like I typically think of movies like Starry Eyes as sort of being on the leading edge of presenting these, in particular focusing on how women are treated in film, not just on screen, but also off screen, by executives and things like that. But even that that came out, I think, a couple of years after The Anatamorphose. So
yeah, it was I think 1 or 2 years after, you're right, and I really like that film. It was really well done, and the woman in that case in the film industry are treated as merchandise, and it's not everywhere and it's not all like that, but yeah, there's a part of that industry that is just like chewing people in and chewing them back and then using people. But more than that, I think that film in itself is an art of using people, about using people. Like whatever you do a movie, like you're, you have a team, you have a crew, which is not the case when you write a book, for example, or even if, when you play in a band, like everyone has that part. But I think that your director is always a certain extent using his comedians and his actors, because they portray something for him. They speak for him. They play what he asks them to do and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of a weird relationship. And yeah, Starry Eye was great for that. But I think that that a lot of our movies, especially now with the elevated kind of horror thing, I hate that term for many reasons, but I kind of forget that they're part of more complex relationships to what to representation and how we work into that into all that into that how can I say that into that industry and into our creation or art. So I kind of I've disagreed there, but I went elsewhere. But yeah, there's a lot of reflections to have on what we're doing.
Talking about Caden's boyfriend, you know, there are a lot of signals in here that he's a bad guy. Beyond the physical things, like one of the moments I think that really jumps out is when they're when all their friends are over and they're asking about her art that she's working on, and he just goes and gets it, and he's going to show it to anyone when it's you know pretty clear that she doesn't really want to talk about it because it's not finished, you know, and it's something that's very personal to her, and he just says, "Oh, I'll go get it." You know,
yeah, actually, it's really funny because that character, sometimes people, the guy, I mean, there's a lot of people that sometimes doesn't understand what I was trying to do with it. He's speaking, you know, we shot a movie in Montreal, we're French Canadian here, and there's a really a strong relationship between French and you'll see where I go with that. It might seem off a little bit right now, but between the French language and the English language, and people mixed up, but sometimes like French Canadian doesn't speak English or English Canadian doesn't speak French. So for me, that character, I really had a lot of fun because I did it like she's obviously she's an American Caden, but she's an English character and he's a French character. So for me, there was kind of already that disruptance between both of them, and more than that, I was really like having fun with the actor to have that character be really off, you know, clumsy and weird because he's off. I kind of he's. Doesn't belong in there. Is not really a kind of a loser. Finally, you know, even though he's trying to act better than that. So we really had a lot of fun doing that. And sometimes people doesn't understand. They think that it's not well. I know there was critics that were saying to me like, "Well, that character is kind of not well played." Well, not really. It was what we wanted. I wanted that character to feel that way. So we feel that he's like. He doesn't belong there, and he's like really that kind of macho, small boy that tries to be bigger than he is actually, and yeah, that really pissed me off, that kind of people. So that was kind of the character actually, and as you say about her art, like it's really what I thought since I when I was telling you that a big part of the script is about my own is close to me, like it's really because the character and her heart in the movies is really a reflection of what I'm living in Quebec, where I don't get fundings for what I do and a lot of refusals and stuff like that from the institutions here. So I kind of channeled it into that character where she's trying to do something. She finally succeeds at the end, at a certain extent. But every everything else just tries to doesn't believe in her first, and they try to crush her. And that character from the guy character was really kind of that that personification of, you know, what are you doing with your life? Why are you doing this? We don't understand. And I want to see, but it's, even though it's not ready, and like joking about it, well, that's not that good. Oh, it's not over. You know, all that kind of cliche or common sentences we hear sometimes, depending on the kind of family we have or the people that surrounds us or the, and really like when he does that with that character, with her, I think it's really, for her, one of the moments where she is, she starts being aware of herself at a certain point, because the scene after is like, it's when she told him like that she gives up and everything, and he doesn't listen to her because he doesn't fucking care and he's sleeping and and he don't want to hear about it. But yeah, that's kind of a turning point for her, that accepting that there's some stuff that aren't working, and that she might also not be that good because she doesn't accept who she is actually. And yeah, for me that scene was and it's one of the rare scenes in the movie where the dialogues and characters actually so yeah, it was kind of a turning point for the character, at least in the writing.
And that's one of the things that I, that I really like about it is you're doing a lot of nonverbal storytelling, so you don't have a lot of opportunities for dialogue, but I still feel like there's still a character, you know, that's being developed, and it's there are stories and about her being told just through the visuals and through her physical acting.
Yeah, well, you feel the character into her body, you know, on screen, and how it's difficult, how it's hard, how she's tired, how she's, you know, she was really amazing because all the movies on her actually. And all of my films, actually, my short films, everything that I write are really more action driven, not in the sense of like car exploding or stuff like that, but characters doing things or existing in the world without having to talk. Because I think for one, the audience is intelligent. And they can understand. They don't need to have to be fed, spoon fed all of the fucking plot points or what's going on. They feel it. They understand. I'm a viewer like everyone. And so I do. So hey, dude. So sometimes I have problem with film that are over script. I would say sometimes there's scenes that for me could have been expressed in purely visual and with sounds. And that's the essence too of cinema or film for me, is like telling stories with pictures and sound, and you can express way more with just a look, a way a body moving a frame, someone grabs something, the sound that surrounds it, everything that are really not put aside, but that is not that that thought about. And I say that there's a lot of movies that do that thing, but I do think that's really what's interesting. And there's some stuff that doesn't need to be said to be done or to have a meaning. Thanatomorphose like that. Well, actually, as you said, she's alone all the time. So the it was we had to find ways to express her transformation, not just with special effects, but with how she acted and what she was doing in her own apartment for the whole movie, since it's a huis clos too. And she's not talking to anyone, so we had to find other ways to express and to get our point across, if we can say it that way. But all, as I said, all my other films, they're really not that much dialogues, actually. The last script that I wrote, which had a way more dialogue, was for a comedy, that an erotic comedy. Well, that isn't produced because, actually, as I said, here the institution doesn't really support what I'm doing, which is okay. I was surprised myself. Like when I was doing a comedy, then there were a lot more dialogue, but they were making no sense anyway. It's actually dialogue for dialogue, but not for dialogue, but that was part of the joke for me. I found it funny in that way. But all my other films, they don't need, characters don't need to talk to express themselves. And I find it way more powerful because when you let bodies express themselves on screen, you're reaching to the affective and the sensory and the not cerebral but the instinctive part of looking at a film and receiving it, and I think that's it connects on another level, and I really like to do it and insist and work on it. That's part of what I like to do when I shoot a movie.
That's one of the things I like about independent films also, because even when there's a studio film, you know, that's really good. I'm, you know, thinking back to something like Get Out, mm-hmm. you know, from a few years ago. And I think about this every time I watch it, because there's a scene, you know, towards the end where the groundskeeper character, you know, is chasing after the our protagonist with, you know, with the shotgun, mm-hmm. and they give the girlfriend this little line of dialogue where she says something like "Go get him, Grandpa," or something like that. I think that's the line, and you know, and it's like I would have liked to have just left that unsaid. I think we figured out that, you know, Georgina and Walter are the grandparents in new bodies. And that was sort of the whole point of the movie, but I feel like that's probably a studio note. You know, there's some producer saying, "Oh, well, we need to make sure the audience understands."
Yeah. Yeah, I do remember that one, and it's just especially difficult when you get into that the horror film, the fantastic films, and all that kind of movies that actually are. There's a lot of unsaid stuff, things that you must perceive or feel. You know, the weirdness of some character doesn't come out when you have them talk about it. Like as you said in Get Out, you understand, and it's really creepier than just when you realize who's inside the bodies and the look and the way they talk and say, "Oh, it finally makes sense." You know, so yeah, it's kind of like hitting the nail too much on something that's, okay, it's working. So don't need to say more than that. You know, we feel it, and it's yeah, that's a strength of that, you know?
Right.
But what's great with making independent film, though, even if sometimes we don't have the mean for our ambition, and we must find other ways around to do what we want to do, is that, yay, nobody tells you what to do. Actually, you can do anything. So sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, because you can also like just do stuff that just doesn't make sense or is really too cryptic or too you need other people sometimes to tell you that it's not a good idea or you should rework something, but at the same time it enables us or people to like a film like Thanatomorphose. I don't see how I would have it done any other ways. I would have had to make compromise or change that thing, or just like, for example, the blowjob scene. For sure, it wouldn't have been that way, you know. So that's one of the great things about independent cinema. There's a lot of room to experiment and to fail sometimes. But yeah, truly, as you say, some when it's well executed as a viewer, you get a lot of you're really rewarded because you feel that you're part of what you're watching and that you're that they respect your your intelligence to watch the movie. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, you get a lot out of you know, of the resources that you put into to Thanatomorphos, probably nowhere more so than in the makeup effects. You know, this is one of the more like visually disturbing movies that that I've ever seen. And you know, big credit to you know, your special effects team in making that happen.
Yeah, actually, we had two special effect artists. One, the main special effect artist was his name is David Scherer. Actually, is working in Europe, so we had him fly here. I knew him from a friend who directed movies where he did the special effects, and David is really amazing. He's really well. He understands that special effects are part of a whole. So it depends on how, you know, you shoot it, how you light it, and the constraint that you have. So it was really amazing working with him because he understood like kind of the director part of making special effects scenes. And since I'm I wrote a book about special effects and I teach the history of special effect and all that kind of stuff, so I knew also how it works, so I can speak his own language. And we really had a nice collaboration because of that, because we could both understand what's working, what's not working, and how we would do that. And we had the same references as far as what kind of gory effects we like. It's really into Italian stuff like Gennaro De Rossi or stuff like that. Like the Fulci movie, he really loves it. But also like the German movies like Necromantic, obviously, the stuff from Jörg Budgereit and stuff like that. So really, it off together when we were working about the movie. He pre-planned a lot of the stuff at his home in Europe, sent it by plane in Montreal. I had to go to the duty to get them. So it was some funny moment with the duty people at the airport to get the stuff, and he came in Montreal to shoot the movie. And we with David, he was on set all the time, so actually we devised for the whole movie, we devised kind of three apart from all this makeup step of the decaying, we devised kind of three type of makeups effects, a little bit like there's three parts in the movie with the subtitles that came in, the cards with so the movie is divided into three parts, and we devise like three look on the color side, on the cinematography side, and in the makeup side. So you at first it's just more beauty makeup like bruises and stuff like that. In the second part there's the prosthetics, the animatronic at some part and all that kind of stuff. And the last part of the movie, well, then we have a full body suit and we have all the stop motion animation and all that kind of stuff. So we really devised three different kind of makeup look. And I told you that I'm a big fan of I work a lot and I think a lot about all that matters with the bodies and the fluids and all that kind of stuff. So so that's also one thing that shows in the movie is that I like all that. I like when you feel texture on screen, when you can touch thing. So obviously that influenced the way I shot all these kind of gory special effects or stuff. And one of the things that I wanted with the movie that I didn't want it to be, I wanted it not to be over the top in a sense that it's over the top because it's unbelievable at some point, but yeah, to stay close to the body of the actress, but to what's going on. And I always find that in movies, the thing that hurts the most are the smaller detail, because as people, there's things that we experimented, like getting burned on the oven, or cutting ourselves with a knife, or having like toothache, having you know, whatever that happened that everybody can relate to. And that's really what I wanted to the other scene, or the scene where we put a lot of emphasis the movie at these small moments, because I know that we can relate to these moments, because as a person, we have experienced that, like, nobody had his head cut off or saw a head cut off in front of him. Well, some people have seen head cut off in front of them, but, you know, it's not a regular experience
right,
for anybody right. to have seen that. And I really like to say what is being true to that. Like, if you cut something, then you know, it's really like the body doesn't react as we see in movies. Oh, it's a lot more messier. So right. It was important to have all that. So with David, we had really a great time, but it was long days sometimes. Yeah, I remember at the end of the movie when she Kaden has the full body suit, and she was really great and patient about it. It was like we would arrive on set at 5, and she would be ready by 11 or noon, and then we'll shoot until like 10 or 11. So it was really like the crazy days for her because of the makeups. And it was hard on her skin, because as you see in the movie, she's from the start, she's having like small bruises and stuff. So she has makeup all along for the whole shoot. So right. The skin, she had really like rash and problem with the skin. It was really, yeah, she was a trooper. But it also helped her performance. I remember when we were talking about it, like, we will shoot the film in continuity for the makeup and all that kind of stuff. But it was really great also to for her, because we were talking like, you will be at one moment pissed off and tired and fed up with all that kind of stuff. And it will show in your character and the way, and not just the way you act, but the way your body will act by itself at one point. You know, you can play at being tired, but when someone is really, really tired, the body has its own ways of showing it. So we decided to together to took that to our advantage when we planned the movie. So yeah, I went from special effects to Kaden having to wear the stuff. And the other makeup artist was Rémi Couture, which is well known here in Canada, because he was trialed for obscenity a few years ago because of a website where he had a kind of serial killer, a fake tape, and it was really well made, you know, and he went in court because the government, someone made a complaint thinking that it was real, and it went to the court.
Oh, wow.
He was also the other makeup artist. Yeah, his story is really crazy. And well, he was not found guilty, but at one point, like, everybody, even the persecution, knew that it was fake stuff, but they keep on going on obscenity charge because they were saying that it was like too much and that's not the stuff that should be distributed or produced. So it was really like his court trial was at just after we shot the movie. So we weren't to that that moment in Quebec, because a lot of my friends too are dealing with, are making films that are kind of extreme. We are kind of a small bunch of filmmakers that work together, or at least do some stuff that are a bit more on that side. And well, we can say that we were a bit concerned, to say the least, about
sure.
the result of his trial.
What a great selling feature for your film too, that hey, our makeup artist was arrested and charged with obscenity. I think that's exactly what you want to hear sometimes. You know, really know what you're in for. And you're right. It's those small moments in horror that really get people. Like, we might all, you know, cheer when the bad guy gets his head cut off or something, and there's some big moment, you know, where somebody just explodes into a million pieces. But if you really want to make an audience, you know, sort of squirm in their seats and make people cringe, you know, it's the little things like, you know, like pulling off fingernails and things like that, mm-hmm. that really, it's far more relatable and far more disturbing.
Yeah, I do think so. One of the scenes that always I always think about when we're talking about that matter is it's in Phenomena, no, not Phenomena, the Tenebrae by Dario Argento, the moment where they just I think they grab the head of the character and they just like bang her face on a desk or something, and it's really the feet you see. You know, and you feel it. It's like just, oh, damn, ouch. That should hurt. But at the same thing, at the end of the movie, when the arm is cut off, you know, it's like, oh, that's cool because they have that kind of geyser of blood that do a really like cum-shutty and things on the wall. But it's more over the top, and that's really fun. But you don't, it's not the same visceral approach to pain or horror or violence.
It was interesting to hear you talk about, you know, a group of filmmakers there in Montreal that are all, you know, interested in extreme cinema, sort of in the spirit of, you know, of guys like Cronenberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had definitely a big influence, and we have in Quebec, in Canada in general, but in Quebec there's also a big community of experimental filmmakers. And that from the 60s, you know, and a lot of experimental filmmakers did really weird thing or great stuff. And it really influenced a lot of younger filmmakers like myself or as I said, my friend, I think like, for example, Frédéric Maheu, was one of my friends who did Anna, drug porn. He did a couple of, it's more on the experimental side, Frédéric, Théorie de la Religion, but yeah, the kind of, affiliation and what we're what we have in Quebec as filmmakers what was done here. And obviously, like for horror film, you know, we had all these horror films shot in Quebec or in Toronto in the 70s, 80s, like the slashers, the Cronenberg films, obviously. So it all had big influences, I think, on certain generation of filmmaker and that want to kind of push the envelope a bit more here. And it's really, yeah, it's really interesting, actually, that it doesn't come out of nowhere, even though it seems, and I don't say that from an outsider perspective, but even in Quebec, like people look sometimes at the work that we do and they say, well, where is it coming from? Well, actually, it's coming from our own experimental cinema and independent cinema, you know, from the 60s, 70s. It's not coming out of nowhere. There's affiliation, maybe not as extreme or the same thing exactly, but it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's exciting. I think it's one of those things that I'm more likely to be drawn to, just because I, you know, over the course of, you know, of working for a horror website and a podcast and, you know, and reviewing films and going to festivals, you tend to see a lot of the same, stories and a lot of the same, you know, tropes over and over again. And, you know, it's fun just to watch something that plays out completely differently, or you know, that just does something that, you know, that I've never seen done in a movie before. You know, that's always exciting to me.
Yeah, you're right. I'm that kind of viewer too. I like to see stuff that, even though sometimes, as I said earlier, it's something might fail, but at least they're trying something. You know, and they're just not redoing the same thing that's working or that we have seen a lot of the time, because, well, that this movie has been made, and I don't find it interesting. Or if you try something, be honest with your subject and go all the way through it, and go to its logical conclusion, or you know, go all in, not just like the toes in the water, like, oh, okay, that's enough. No, go for it, you know? And I really like these movies that are ballsy like this. No, fuck off. That's what I want to do, and I will go all through it. And you will follow me or not. Afterward, that's your sensibility, and you sometimes it works for some people or not, but I really respect these films. All these films, even though I don't like all of them, but I respect the this kind of that kind of as in French we could say jusqu'au boutiste, but yeah, to go to the end of the world or something. You know? I don't know exactly how to translate that, but and these movies sometimes it's really funny because a couple of years later you see in more mainstream movies stuff that were clearly inspired by these films. It kind of just took a time to get there, and that's also a testament to their impact and their influence. They can't be mainstream because like a film like Thanatomorphose, it's impossible for everyone to like it, and it doesn't want to be liked by everyone anyway. The movie don't want that, and it shouldn't, because that's what horror is for me. It's not fun. It's not. It's hard. It's an experience. It's like makes sense that it stays underground, because as long as it stays at one point at a certain level of underground, it means that it still works for what was aimed with or its purpose. And there's a lot of great movies that if suddenly they became mainstream, that wouldn't, like, I would love them anyway. But what I'm trying to say is that their existence or their function or their impact is directly linked to, at one point, they are dealing with either taboo subject or doing something that goes a little bit extreme because they want to discomfort. They want to shake thing. they just don't want to be a crowd pleaser, or that's not their aim. And as long as we have movies like that, I think that our cinema will thrive, because that's their strength. That's the strength of our cinema, having us. Making us deal with things that we don't want to deal with, or making us feel things that we don't want to feel. And yeah, as long as we have that, all is good.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And I love that kind of experimental spirit, and it does clearly influence other filmmakers. You know, there have been a number of occasions where I'll watch, you know, a movie that's 10 or 15 years old, and that isn't really that popular, and then I'll see things that I recognize from you know, from movies from 2 or 3 years ago, you know, and I just realize that those ideas just kind of you know, they may make their way around, and you know, and a lot of filmmakers like to watch, you know, other you know, films from other filmmakers, so you know that they're all seeing, you know, what their peers are doing, and you know, and I think it's you know, entirely appropriate, you know, when people, you know, will, you know, they'll say, oh, I like that, I'm going to use that in a movie down the road or something. I mean, that's just sort of the nature of art, you know, is that the great artists, you know, just steal little, you know, bits and pieces of other things and kind of remix it and make it their own, and that's been going on for, you know, hundreds of years.
Yeah, that's great, because it means that it speaks to someone, it speaks to people, and it made it alive, it made it interesting, and everyone has their own sensibility, so everything can be done. We were talking earlier on about like movie that does the same thing that we've seen and everything, but you know, everything has pretty much been done anyway, but what's different is the sensibility of the person that express it, and how they make a subject or something their own. Sometimes they don't know that another piece of art that has the same subject exists, but either if they do or they don't, what's interesting is how someone can channel his own vision to others, and that will always be the case. And it's a mix of influences, it's a mix, a lot of things. And then there's that original part that is the creator wants, that's it's or her, and that's where it works. When someone finds his or her sensibility, and not just like actually shot for shotting, you know,
right?
Shot a movie. Well, okay, then yeah, it's like making high grade sausages in a factory, you know, yeah, okay, cool. Tastes good in the end, your hot dog is good, but still, it's all made the same. It's all the same thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, I love that. I love seeing something, yeah, I love seeing something different. I, you know, the Renaud Gauthier made a film, I think, last year, the year before, called Aquaslash.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't very well received, at least by a lot of people that I spoke to. But you know, when I watched it, it's and I understand it to an extent, because it's you know, like for the majority of the movie, it's just this like teen melodrama, and then like in the last, I don't know, like 15 minutes is where all the gore and all the kills happen. But it's also, I feel like, kind of, you know, satirizing those teen slashers in a way, because, you know, the sort of the smarmy criticism of a movie like that is, oh, if you really had a water park that you know, where people started dying, like, they would shut it down, and that's kind of what he made is yeah, as soon as all the kills happen, now the movie's over. And you know, and I kind of figured that out you know, right away. I was a big fan of his other film, Discopath, so I kind of figured out early on what he was up to. But yeah, and I just love stuff like that.
Yeah, well, actually, we were talking about René Couture, but he did the special effect not on Aquaslash, but on Discopath. So yeah, with Renaud. But yeah, you're right, and I think there's something interesting too. I mean, the audience, like, there's people that are more rational than others that can just go with the flow, you know. And we see that all the time. You know, there's always someone in the room that says, well, it doesn't make sense because that thing. Well, dude, it's a movie, you know. It's if I want reality, I will just go outside and, you know, see what's going on. So yeah, sure, you're right, but no, beyond that. But there's people that can't, like, go beyond that, and it's okay. That's how they deal with it. But sometimes, yeah, some criticism are harsh, because it's like, well, actually, you know, a fantastic film, you know, yeah, sure, but that's a vampire anyway, so the sense there, no, it doesn't exist, it won't. So yeah, rationality and causality, yeah, sure, but go figure, you know. Yeah. It's like, well, you know that there is monster in the movie, yeah, so I think that for a start, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
but yeah, Renaud with Aquaslash, and it kind of had trouble to finding the distribution. I think it's not easily available, so that's kind of a sad thing for his movie.
Yeah, that's a shame. Because it's such a time capsule. Both of his both Discopath and Aquaslash, I mean, they're different eras, but they're just sort of and it's funny, because it's sort of capturing this like slice of Americana, but through a Canadian lens, because Discopath is set, or at least the first half of it is set in New York City, and I think Aquaslash, I get the feeling it's supposed to be set, you know, like somewhere like in the, you know, in the Midwestern United States, you know, and but it's clearly you know, sort of like a Canadian sort of view of Americans, which is funny to me.
And all the films that we got to here, you know,
right,
kind of special for us when we were a kid in the 80s. Renaud is a bit older than me, so end of the 70s, but all the movies that we were watching on video or at the TV, that kind of was the first contact that we had with, you know, the USA. as the USA has a first contact with Canada through our work of arts. But yeah, it's always funny, like how we internalize and perceive, even though we know that's not the case, but how we all that baggage of references, of looks, of that how we channel it.
So I want to talk a little bit about the Tetra video release real quick, because I bought the film on Apple iTunes or Apple Movies or whatever it's called now, you know, about a year ago, and then I just got the Tetra release, and I watched them both, and it looks like there's like a different color grading on the Tetra Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. So I think it's about 5 minutes shorter. So was there a new edit done for this release?
No, actually, I think it's just because of the frame rate. That's really it, because when I've sent the, it's a long story short, but when I sent the material to Tetra, actually sent the an edit, not an edit, a transcode that was made for European theater. So actually, the frame rate is not the same as.
Okay.
US, so that explained probably why it's a couple of minutes shorter, because I didn't do any edit in the movie. I'm not that type of filmmaker. When something is out, it's out. So, and I will never go back on a film to change it. So that's not part of me. Even though if I watch something a couple of years after and I say, oh well, that could have been, but no, I won't never do that. I'm not the George Lucas type. So actually, that's really the transfer. And the long story short for that is that we had all the original material of the movie. It was shot digitally on some hard drives, and we lost everything.
Oh no!
Yeah. So I had to contact a past distributor and some people to find another master of the movie, because I didn't have one, and I lost everything. So I found, I think it was, I had a copy that was still in Spain, which was transferred for European market. So that's why the frame rate is different. So yeah, like behind the scenes stuff, stories that I'm telling you right now. And for the color grading, I just think that's the, because of the using that master, but also the encoding for the Blu-ray, that changed some color sometime because of the log spec. So
yeah.
Really technical stuff, but we didn't like regrade or change anything for that release, actually.
Okay.
So even though it seemed, it's not the case.
Yeah. Well, I will say the Blu-ray, it looks much nicer. But I think, you know, the physical is probably always going to look better than digital or streaming anyway, just because there's more there's more data that you can decode that much more quickly from a physical disc. So the new Blu-ray looks fantastic, and there's tons of special features on there, and it looks great. I'm happy. I'm happy for you, because I had the DVD from Unearth Films. I think that's mm-hmm. who released it here in the States. But I definitely wanted that that high def copy. So
yeah, I'm really happy to and amazed that a small movie, though, you know, got that kind of treatment. And even when it was released, like the Unearth Films. In Europe, we had Uncut Movies that released the film. We had several company that released it in the world, and especially in that age of piracy, and everyone that just grabbed these kind of films, they download it, You know, I'm really amazed that every time that someone says to me, I have that this edition, or even when Tetro wrote to me about releasing the Blu-ray, I was like, damn, that's really cool. For one part, because as you said, it will look better than online. The compression is not the same because of like data bandwidth, because of how to put it like on Vimeo or whatever, that you have to compress it. You can just put that 100 giga octet file, and anyway, these platforms recompress for their own recipe to be able to stream and everything. So to have a good physical release, that's really amazing. And I'm always amazed, yeah, at how many releases there have been, and where it went, and how people react, and how people still discover it. It's really, I didn't believe it would be the case actually, and yeah, it's great. And I'm a physical guy, as you understand from all the interview, but more than physical, not really physical in that aspect. But even myself, movies, I bought them. I still bought them. Records, books, and everything. I like to have the object, and because there's tangibility and there's something that can't be, that can't disappear. Like I was telling you about the hard drive that just, we lost everything.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, you know, it's digital. Yeah, that's it. So if, like, whenever I can, I try to have physical, well, in that case, it's a DVD Blu-ray, but I have another film that's on 35 millimeter film. We shot digitally, but we got it on 35 millimeter film. I have another one that is, we did like Betek MSP tapes to have master that are physical. So I'm always like that. Well, to say the least, I'm really amazed at the edition, but that it exists.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, and it's great. It's a great collectible. The artwork is fantastic. I think they really did a good job. So
yeah,
really, really happy.
Yeah, you're right. The drawing and everything, and all the extras on the DVD. Well, it's actually pretty much all the short films I've made. There's my mid-length porn one that isn't on there, but for distribution reason and all that stuff, because it wasn't produced by me. But everything else is there. So I'm really, it's really cool. Really happy with that.
Yeah, it's awesome. All right, Eric, I appreciate your time this morning. I want to thank you for coming on and talking to me about your film. You know, is there anything else, anything that you're working on right now, or anything that you want to plug, or, you know, tell people where to find you, or find out about what's coming next?
Yeah, well, everyone can go on my website. It's myname.com. And I'm working on a short film shot on Super 8 millimeter, which is a sex magic ritual with gory effects and all that kind of stuff. It's really cool. We're editing it right now. So all shot on film, which will came out, so a short film. And I will soon start doing some initiative to toward shooting another feature length next year, which will be an horror film also, but I won't say too much for now, and it will obviously be independently produced. So so if people want to see, follow, help when we will release our campaign at one moment, just go on my website. That's really cool.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I will link that in the show notes also. Okay, Eric, thanks again. I really appreciate this. I won't take up too much more of your time, but thank you very much.
No problem, Patrick, and thank you to for having me on your show, and hello to everyone who's listening.
Absolutely. All right. You have a good day. Take care.
Cool. Yeah, you too. Thank you very much.